Merry Christmas. I'm Larry, and I'm a jolly old alcoholic. I want to thank Norma and Yakult Ray for bringing me a great distance and expense from Richfield. It's not so easy to get here from Richfield. There were days in my past when I started out and I never made it. You got to get past Harry's Tavern in Duluth and Jolly's at Junction and Stagecoach in North Hazeldale, plus the liquor stores out that way. There was one time when I was going the other direction from Vancouver and I never made it. Vancouver isn't exactly overpopulated with trees, and you can imagine how hard it is for an alcoholic pickup to find a tree in the fog. Yet that stopped it. I'm going to break this talk into two parts. First, I'm going to share my experience, strength, and hope, because that formula is infallible. And then secondly, because I have some special skills, I'm a recovering physician as well, I'm going to give you or tell you what I see in recovering people. And you can leave for the second part if you'd like. If you're not recovering, you're welcome to stay. Alcoholics Anonymous, or AA, the other term is Attitude Adjustment. This is our Miller time for those of us who are recovering. For those that are still practicing, there's enough experience in this room to probably tell you how to get here if you want. Everybody's story is unique, and we live in that uniqueness, I think. I started from an alcoholic family with an alcoholic father and a very loving mother. Who all the time. And I grew up in that environment, and we moved a lot. Our life could at times be very exciting. My father in the car would go out on Saturday night, and only my father would come home. My mother would wish we had the car. So we changed cars often, and we moved often, and I changed and went to about five or six different schools in the first 3 years of starting school. And I never understood why, and there were always good reasons given by my mother, which never made sense, but these were promotions or some such thing to different jobs in different areas. And when you grow up with this kind of insanity going on around you, you begin to not pay very much attention to what they're saying. Likewise, there was a lot of physical abuse, which never went any place in our family. My father would come home drunk, my mother would go yang 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 yang, and you could hear it coming, you know. He would begin to suddenly get mad and angry, and you could hear her start screaming before she was ever hit. And you know, for all the screaming that woman did, I never did see a bruise on her. And that's the way alcoholic families frequently are. The thing that I got out of all this is that one doesn't rely on other people very much. You keep your head tucked in so it doesn't get hit. You keep your feelings to yourself, and you depend on yourself to get where you're going. To this day, or at least till I got into this program, I could arrive in a strange city and insist I could find an unknown address without a map. If it took me 2 hours, I'd be driving around trying to figure it out without asking for help. That was just the way I was programmed. And, you know, if you ask me and I stopped and thought about it, as soon as I got over my anger, I'd say, yeah, it sounds silly, kind of, you know. But I didn't really change those habits very fast. In any event, I did find out I was very good at studying. And so the glimmer of hope came that through all of this kind of middle class or high, low class mediocrity, I was going to get out of that situation. And I was going to do it through studying and through education. That was going to be my salvation. I'd already decided that religion wasn't the route. All they did was wanted donations on Sunday, and that was going the wrong way. So I proceeded to study, and I did very well. And as such, I can tell you that I took a drink or two during my high school years on fishing trips with my father, and I don't recall that there was anything spectacular about it. And certainly through the time I was in college and medical school, drinking was still a negative influence in my life. It slowed me up or prevented me from getting where I was going. And I did not intend to let anything stop me from getting where I was going. When I did drink, interestingly enough, there were some very alcoholic things that happened. I can remember my first drunk in college, which was an initiation party for a co-op that I belonged to or lived in which it was standard for everybody to get drunk on beer. And my roommate had gotten some chocolate candy or something from his mother, that fudge that she sent him, and we proceeded to mix copious amounts of beer and chocolate candy, with the result that I couldn't get my head up off the pillow the rest of the night. And we slept in these three-tiered bunks, and I was on the top bunk. And I was had the whirlies so bad every time I woke up that there was no way I was going to make to the John, so I just kind of rolled my head over the side and vomited. That was my first instance of sharing with one of my fellow men. When I woke up, looked down in the morning, the guy down at the bottom had been drunker than I was, and he didn't know the difference anyway, and I just got up and got out of there before he knew. Having found that the road to success was study, and I continued to study and studied my way right on through college and medical school and into an internship and residency and subspecialties. And along the way, I was on the East Coast at that point at Bellevue Hospital in New York, and I married a girl from the East Coast who was everything that I thought that I needed along the way. She was college-born, or Eastern-born, bred and college-trained in the finer schools, and her family was very lovely. And so I proceeded to spend my first Thanksgiving meeting her family with my head in the toilet, because we got up in the morning and went for a nice walk down by the seashore, and the family that invited us over for Thanksgiving dinner invited us in. We started drinking whiskey sours at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I was such a hit that day that I never showed up at the table. I was still sick on the couch. So it was very apparent that when I did drink, I got into it pretty well. And I kind of lived by that philosophy that work hard and play hard, and anything in between was a waste of time. And that philosophy seemed to be pretty good, as long as my playing didn't consist of drinking. Because I continued to spend long hours working and starting a practice and finishing a home here in Vancouver when I finally got here, I continued to be protected. I continued to not drink. I always had something else to do that I didn't want alcohol to interfere with. And having pretty much achieved all my goals, I suddenly began to sit back and admire the handiwork with a drink in my hand. And the more I drank, the more I realized that my profession was fine, my business was fine, my home was fine, but the marriage was crooked. And I was still young enough how to straighten that out. And the way to straighten that out was to get rid of the wife, because she was screaming and hollering every time I came home. The kids were crying as a result, and I didn't understand why such a nice guy had worked so hard and got so many nice things for her when he came home ought to be yelled at like that. And we went to marriage counseling, and I've heard but never tracked it down that the psychiatrist was more alcoholic than we were. Should have recognized it, you'd think, but he played right into it. He agreed with me I ought to get rid of her because she yelled too much. That's the way I heard it. She may have heard something else. Having gotten from the psychiatrist exactly the definitive opinion I wanted, I proceeded to put that course into action, program of action. I moved out in Richfield, away from everything, where I could throw a beer bottle in any direction, still have it land on my own property. I always thought that was a good reason for owning land. And I had the last of my restrictions removed from my drinking. I now live by myself in a little farmhouse out in the country, and I could drink whenever I wanted to. I don't understand these stories about people hiding beer bottles or hiding liquor bottles in toilet tanks and closets and bassinets and whatnot, because it always just sat right on the counter. That was the bar when you came in. It was always there for anybody who wanted to have it. And all the people who came there drank. There weren't many people that were interested in coming there that didn't drink. It's funny how that works. When it's free, you have a lot of friends. Anyway, what happened then was that I suddenly was hit. Actually, I got all the court placed on me certain economic restrictions. I was expected to support my children, which I thought was reasonable. I was expected to some extent, support this lady that had yelled so much that I'd left her, but I granted that that probably was also reasonable. And the court was lenient. They made it 3 years for the alimony, and then I was out of that one. I just had the child support. So I was actually starting to get ahead, and I suddenly was hit with depression. This really threw me. I could understand depression if I didn't have money or I was having problems in something that I wasn't solving. What I couldn't understand is at a point in my life when I again thought that things were getting better, and I suddenly really felt blue and down, where it came from, or how to deal with it, or what to do. I knew that drinking didn't make it better, but in the evening I wasn't so depressed, so I'd go ahead and drink. And there was a lot of times when I woke up in the morning and I thought, you know, I admire people who don't drink. Maybe I ought to try that. But by afternoon I'd lost that goal. That was pretty short-lived. It was good for about 2 hours in the morning. And I was never one to drink in the morning. I want to make that very clear right here. I did carry scope in my car. I was the scoper from Richfield. Somehow or other, you know, in my twisted imagination, it made sense that, you know, you can smell alcohol on somebody. I knew that even when I was drinking, even if they drank vodka. That stuff sits in your stomach, you know, and those odors are emanating up out of your stomach. So if you want the scope to work, you got to put it where the action is. You got to put it down in the stomach, right? Made sense to me. I always bought scope when it was on sale in the largest bottle they sold, kept it right by the seat of my car, and would sip on it all the way to work. Well, I didn't want to spit it out and have it splash down the side of my car. Besides, the window didn't open all the time on that side. But I did not drink in the morning. Now, I knew that scope was 14% alcohol, and it probably might ease the hangover a bit. But that wasn't the same as mixing a drink. Yeah. And I drank the same way. You know, I always was interested in drinks that took some craftsmanship to them. I didn't want to just pour vodka over the ice. That would be a little bit questionable. So I got into martinis, where you have to at least wave a little bit of vermouth over the gin. And I had 6 olive martinis. That's the way I liked them. I didn't want to get up all the time and have to keep mixing another one. And I don't have a shot glass that doesn't have cobwebs in it. I don't know who buys all those shot glasses, because I've never heard of an alcoholic yet that ever measured a drink. You start measuring those buggers one at a time and it becomes apparent how much you're really putting down. When I ended up, I actually had a system that was so scientific that it was that was unique. Probably every alcoholic has done the same thing. I would come home, I had a cocktail shaker glass that was large. I would put a fair amount of ice in there because that way I wasn't filling the whole thing up with vodka. I would put a splash of Kahlua in there with the vodka because that made it a Black Russian. It wasn't drinking vodka over the rocks. And it always sat in the door of the freezer when I wasn't drinking on it. And there was no shot glass. So whenever it started to get down anywhere as close to the bottom, I would just pour some more vodka in, throw in the Kahlua. I had my Black Russian, or rather weak Russian, actually. But White Russian is what I had. And nobody ever measured it. I can't tell you to this day how much I drank. The problem was that I was buying Kahlua in half-gallon bottles. And those were accumulated. Now, the vodka bottles, you know, everybody that came to my house drank vodka, so I could blame all that on them. But the Kahlua bottles, I'm the only one that was drinking the Kahlua, and I was mixing them 30-1. You know, and here's half-gallon bottles of Kahlua. That begins to wear on your denial a bit. My partners begin to wear on my denial a bit. I began to have personality changes. I was getting angrier and angrier and angrier. And that's, you know, I realize today is because the world wasn't going according to my design. And I really wasn't built to tolerate that frustration. I've heard Stan Getlow, who's one of the experts in alcoholism, talk several times from his practices in New York City. And he clearly points out that if there's a fault that alcoholics have, it's that they're too responsible. They want to take on the load of the whole world. And when they can't accomplish that and they can't correct everything to their own satisfaction and their own perfection, there is no cure for that pain except to drink or take some medication. And so that's how we frequently get into trouble. And that's exactly where I was getting. And I guess the other thing that eroded my denial a bit was I did recognize that my life wasn't on an upward slant. I was going through personal relationships one after another and began to wonder what was wrong. After you go through four or five, you begin to suspect that maybe they're not all wrong, that there's something wrong at home. And at that same time, I began to wonder why I wasn't getting ahead financially. Well, there was a very obvious reason as to why I wasn't getting ahead financially. I had a number of credit cards. And when I ran out of money, I took out another credit card. And I had them all loaded to the maximum because I didn't want to interfere with anything that I had planned or I had to do because I needed to do all these exciting things like go to Mexico or take trips to whitewater rafting, things like this. All of which cost money, which I didn't have at the time when I was still paying alimony and child support and getting out of the hole. So my answer to this was to postpone the pain. Use a credit card, use it, and if that one got too loaded, take out another one. Well, my check was always gone. I had to pay pay something on all these credit cards when the first of the month came. And, you know, even before I stopped drinking, I began to realize that probably it isn't how much you make, it's how much you spend that's the problem. And I was trying to work on that a bit. But before I got there, my partners came along and they had a better solution. They had witnessed the car wreck in 78. So May 26th of 82, they invited me in for a little talk, and I thought we were going to talk about some funny things that had happened when I was on call, when I was drinking one night. All of which I was going to have to really think fast because I didn't remember too clearly all the details. But it involved an elderly lady who complained about palpitations and took the ambulance all the way from Amboy to the hospital, and I proceeded to discuss with her the high cost of medicine in this day and age and how taking an ambulance from Amboy was inappropriate, all of which had nothing to do with her right to take the ambulance. And was entirely inappropriate when this poor little old lady was to be harassed by a physician in there at night. She did not want to hear about medical economics when her heart was palpitating. Yeah. People are unreasonable when you're drinking. They can be unreasonable when you're not drinking. But I don't have to get in and make with the insanity and make it worse today. Anyway, they offered me two places I could go to treatment, neither of which I'd ever heard of, since I really had not made it my hobby to look into the alcohol treatment programs. But one was in San Diego. Now, I'd been to Mexico three times, and I figured from San Diego I can walk to Mexico. If I don't like what's going on, I'm not going to have them run my life. We'll bail out, because I can make a living in Mexico as a doctor somehow. And what I really found out when I got to the treatment center is that if there were any questions in my mind as to whether this applied to me, they were entirely removed within a day or two. First of all, there was a film in there called The Family Trap by Sharon Wegscheider, which some of you may have seen or heard of or had a chance to see. But it points out that if you're an only child and your father's an alcoholic, you'll be a super achiever, and if you choose to drink, an alcoholic, with a very high probability. And I'm sitting here living this role out, thinking, my God, this is interesting. I wonder why doctors never know about these things. And alcoholics only find out about it when they get the treatment. They put it in the one place an alcoholic would never look, in a treatment center. Well, that was the good news. I found out I was alcoholic. I qualified. The bad news was that out of the 12 steps, only the first half of the first one mentioned alcohol. The other 11 and a half all had to do with the fact I was crazy. And that was really good news. I wanted to hear that beyond being an alcoholic. But I could see that what they were talking about. The closest thing to a spiritual awakening I've ever had is when my partner sat me down and said I needed to go to treatment. Because if you think an alcoholic mind thinks fast, you ought to have heard the buzz that went through my computers at that moment. So everything I could possibly think of as an excuse, I could see would just be another form of denial. And everything that had been going on around me in my life, my kind of steady downward spiral, problems with my children, my ex-wife, things like this, probably in some way that I didn't understand, all related to alcoholism. And all this I could see in a flash. That doesn't mean that I accepted it in a flash. But I did have that inkling in a split second that all the doors that had been closed to me during my lifetime could swing open if I chose to use the single key, acceptance. Now we have conferences which they say, acceptance is the key. Well, I've known that for 3.5 years. I'm an old timer now in this program. With 23 and 13 years sitting over here. But that was amazing to me. The next thing that I came to, though, and somebody said right off the bat in treatment, you know, nobody's too dumb for this program, but a lot of people are too smart. I said, gee, it's the program for doctors. If you choose your own home improvement course, you can fail rather flagrantly here. And since my best thinking had gotten me there, I had to accept the fact that there were powers greater than myself, and that I needed to do as I was told. And that's exactly what I did. Denial exists on many levels, as we all know. The thing that was amazing to me was to really step back, though, and look how I had been leading my life, not only from the economic disaster standpoint, and social relationship disaster standpoint. But when I go clear back to college and medical school, I had a hard time ever enjoying the day I was in. Because I was always saying, things are going to be better tomorrow. If I can get past this next 2 weeks of studying for this exam, then life is going to open up for me. Well, I only got through that to be studying another 2 weeks for the next one. And then another 2 weeks, and another 2 weeks, and years, you know, months roll into years. And I had lived the first 20 years of my adult life waiting for tomorrow to come and get better. And the drinking had to go for me to hear what I have to do to get better. But the amazing thing to me was the fact that I had never, you know, these stupid little sayings in this program. God, they frosted me when I got there. You know, who wants to hear one day at a time? That's what I needed. A college graduate physician has to come to this program to learn how to manage his life on a daily basis, to learn how to live in today. That was the amazing part. I heard somebody talk a week ago, and they were talking about how hard they were using the program to keep from drinking. I don't think I've ever been tested as far as the urge to drink. I have a lot of thoughts about it, preoccupations. But I'm so busy using the tools on a daily basis to live, I don't have time to worry about drinking. And that's one of the foregone conclusions, that I may be tested in my own time and place as to an urge to drink. But for the moment, I don't have a drinking problem, I have a thinking problem. I need every one of the tools I've been given in this program in order just to live day to day and enjoy as much of it as I can. But anyway, they finally let me out. I was a fast graduator. I got out in 24 days. I was shooting for 18. My daughter's graduation was at 18 days or something. I was really conning them. I really believed everything, but I wanted to go. But he said, well, we detect some transient neurological deficits. Now, you know what transient neurological deficits are. That's the temporary form of wet brain. I didn't like to hear that. I liked the term. That sounded nice. I thought I'd remember that one, use it at meetings. What I found out, now that I've been talking to my sponsor, he says after 13 years, he's still waiting for him to go away. There are blanks in my memory. There's a period in my life where it's really quite vague because I just didn't pay any attention. With drinking, I really didn't pay that much attention to the news and the current rock groups and the current movies and things like that. And that was very equivalent to that period of time when I was in medical school and I wasn't drinking, but I also kind of shut off from the outside world. So now I'm out here and I've got significant blackouts that go on for years in my past, and I still from time to time have problems as far as meeting people and never remembering names, even though I've met them 5 times before. It gets worse when you might meet them in an AA meeting, you might meet them in a social organization that you work with, you might meet them in your office, they might be your patient, for Christ's sake, you know. They might be all of the above, and you still don't remember their name. And sometimes you have to get down and use the short form of the Serenity Prayer. Fuck it. You know. There's only so much you can deal with, you know. Paul O talks about his famous phrase, you know. He says he brings this problem to his sponsor and he lays it out in great detail with all the intricate manifestations and obvious things that could go wrong if he doesn't make the right decision. And when he's carried this on at great length and he's sure that his sponsor understands it, his sponsor says, whatever. He said, and that's the problem with problems. If you don't really work on them and nurture them, they collapse. They go away. Problems take a lot of thought, a lot of time you've got to spend on them. And I can spend still a significant portion of my time clearing away the wreckage of the future. Yeah. Has not yet arrived, but I'm prepared to worry about it. Well, where am I today? Well, at the time I went to treatment, I had this lovely young thing living with me she was having blackouts when she went out, and I was having blackouts when I went out, and we were both coming home and not telling much about the other one about our blackouts. But she looked so good when I was drinking that she even looked better when I sobered up. And so, because I was doing so well, she thought, in treatment, at least I was laughing a lot down there when I called her from California, she went to AA to find out what I was doing. And that's where Jim Edwards is a very special person in our life, because Jim was the one that she happened to run into who helped her kind of cross that gap as to where she was with this illness. And as she told me that she had a problem with alcohol, and I didn't have to tell her, it made her acceptance that much better. In looking at that, I began to look at the family illness. And at one time in my life, I sat down and I wrote out all the names of people I'd associated with to any degree that I could remember in 5 minutes. Alcoholics don't like to spend too much time at anything. But I had 26 names. And out of the 26, 25 either are alcoholic or come from alcoholic families, without a question. And the 26th one comes from a dysfunctional family of a different variety. And so I began to kind of get this concept as to how I pick out friends and who's attractive to me. And it turns out it's people who are as damaged as I am. Those are the people that I like to associate with. And it's never, when I look at that concept, it's true, almost always. And at least it works for me. At least that lets me know where I'm coming from, and I don't fool myself intellectually with how I make right decisions about this person being articulate and knowledgeable and smooth and all the other things. Because I don't make intellectual decisions when I make friends. I make emotional decisions. My stomach makes them for me and my head just kind of goes along with it. Yeah. And as soon as I found that out, it was a real revelation to me. But it helps me in dealing with people in my office because I don't sit there and intellectually try to figure out so much where they are. I kind of ask myself how I feel with what they're saying. You know, and if my gut says it sells for $60 a ton, I know it's bullshit. You know, if they say this is gold, this is genuine, this is golden, when I'm listening to somebody, I probably will go with what they're saying. I believe what they say. Anyway, what I did was I came home from treatment, and I began going to AA, and I got two sponsors, because alcoholics are the type of people that if you say you can have all you can drink for $5, they all take two. And so I had two, and I began to work the steps. I went through a very stringent program. They require that you get through one step in treatment. Figured that was probably as much as a doctor could handle, you know. So I came back and then began to work through the rest of them. I paid off my credit cards, and I do so at the end of each month, so I don't owe anything on my credit cards. Married the lady that was living with me because she's so lovely, and we put money in the bank. Eventually we hope to build a new house. As I began to work, though, in my practice, I couldn't practice the way I used to. It used to be run them through, give them a diagnosis and a number, you know, and send them to the lab. I couldn't do that because I was horrified to find out that a lot of these people that I'd been seeing for years, not only some of them were alcoholics, but many of them came from alcoholic families. And I estimate that somewhere between 25% and 40% of the patients I see in my office, especially for certain types of complaints, come from alcoholic families. And what are the things that I see, or how do I pick up the diagnosis? I look for those kinds of stress-related complaints that affect three systems. The first one and most obvious one is the musculoskeletal system. Frequently they come in with complaints of headaches or low back pain. Amazing number of people, when I watch the people going through treatment programs, at a young age have had low back surgery. And 75% of them have had some significant intervention by a physician or a chiropractor because of back pain. If they want to really get sophisticated, many of them have the diagnosis of migraine headache. Migraine headache entitles you to go to the emergency room and get a shot of Demerol and Vistarol every so often. And that one is tough. Toughest problem I deal with in recovering people is a pain problem behind on which they can focus. Once they focus on the pain, recovery tends to stop. It's almost the same as the alcoholic who continues to come to meetings but drinks in between. He goes through the motions, but he doesn't grow. In part because his perceptions are altered or blocked for 72 to 96 hours after he uses. So even though he may not be using that day or drinking, his perception, he will not have the urge or the motivation to make the changes that he needs to. The second system that we're running into, and this is a real eye-opener for me, was the fact that probably 40% of our hypertensive patients are still drinking. So it's the cardiovascular system. Today, a patient who has hypertension is asked not to drink for two reasons. One, the alcohol in any amount will make his hypertension worse, but the medications that he takes for hypertension or high blood pressure all of them that you read that say alcohol is contraindicated. Palpitations of the heart and atypical chest pains are the other two that come in this category. The end result of the cardiovascular system is the one that shortens the lifespan of alcoholics frequently nowadays, and much more so than cirrhosis, because I see them coming in nowadays, and much more so than cirrhosis, because I see them coming in at a relatively young age with heart attacks or strokes. By relatively young, I mean in the 50s, and that's not uncommon. The third system is the GI tract. I've got a number of patients that have had bleeding ulcers, and I have in my chart they had two drinks. They told me they drank socially. They had two drinks a day. And now I look at them, I just take one look at the face. I've seen it in a dozen AA meetings. Face just like it, with the redness and the wrinkles and the tough look to it. And these aren't guys that spend all their days on a tractor. They're not out in the wind and the rain. So, the other part of the GI tract is the lower bowel or irritable bowel syndrome, spastic colitis, it used to be called. The GI tract is really the barometer of how you feel inside. And the more tense you are inside, the more negative feelings you carry around inside, the more problems you may have in that area. The interesting part of this is that when the patient comes in and complains of one of these three systems, I don't know until I start to really get at their drinking history whether they're a family member or they're an alcoholic. I cannot tell them apart. And occasionally, there's no alcoholism in the picture at all. They're from a dysfunctional family, from some other etiology, but they react in the same way. The significance of this is that those people who come in from alcoholic families, of course, have high risk, higher than normal risk of chemical dependency. If the physician is not aware of this and he offers one of the tranquilizers or standard narcotic, Temprin number 3, Percodan, whatever is your pleasure, you can set off or begin a process that will lead to all the things that we see in the alcoholic. I'm one of the few physicians that knows this. And as much as I and one or two of my partners who know this also talk to other physicians about it, most of them will not believe it. And so from your standpoint, you really are responsible for your own program. And you know what medications can make you worse and what can interfere with your recovery. And you have to be prepared to defend what you've learned, in spite of the fact that a physician says, well, a few of these won't hurt you. Maybe a few won't. But if they continue on over a long period of time, they can. And I wouldn't want to risk my program on that. The thing that that all of this has really helped me with is the fact that I have, when I graduated from medical school, I graduated with MD, that stands for medical deity. As Jim Edwards has said, I started with a medical deity degree, and I worked that into to the point where I became a legend in my own mind. It took the pain of an intervention and a treatment program to erase that concept of, and at least give me a basis for stopping self-will run riot. Today, I have a spirituality which I would never have approached in the past. Alcohol was that spirituality when I was drinking. Today, the difference is that whereas I drove alcoholics off the deep end before, I'm now prepared to start confronting them. I have a license that most people in AA don't have. And that's the fact that I can look somebody else in the eye and I can say, I think you're an alcoholic. Because I can do that with professional training behind me. AA has a very strong approach that you don't go around labeling other people. And yet, I think it's having been there and recognizing how painful it is to be trapped in a disease that you don't even recognize, to let one person walk through my office without at least mentioning that to him, hurts. And I guess it's probably appropriate at Christmas time, but I suppose if there was a way I wanted to pull people together, in my infinite wisdom, if I went back to my old grandiose days, I would give people a disease that they could not recognize themselves. And it would depend on other people with the same disease recognizing them and going to them and talking, just talking, no medications, no nothing, as the greatest form of love that we give. When you people come here and you listen to me and you help me to get well, that's a form of love. Merry Christmas.
My name is Joyce, and I'm a member of Al-Anon. And if I had known Ray was going to ask me to do this tonight, I'd have stayed home. I had a good night's sleep last night, and I wasted that whole thing because I didn't worry about this. I've never done this before, and it's hard for me to tell you what I'm like, because if you find out what I'm like, you won't like me probably too much. I've learned a lot in the Al-Anon program. Some of it's been funny, some of it's been painful. The alcoholism experience was very frightful to me. I was raised from old parents, and I heard someone say one night that embarrassed them that they were raised, their parents were old, and mine were. My mother was 45 or so when I was born. My dad was in his 50s. Everybody thought he was pretty admirable, but I had 7 brothers, and I was the last. I was his girl. So he protected me and took care of me and solved all my troubles and didn't let me find out what the real world was really like. I married 2 times and had 3 children before I met my present husband. And I'd never been around alcoholism. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know anything about AA or Al-Anon. I just breezed through my life, and if things didn't suit me too well or I'd had enough, I just packed up my kids in my suitcase and we were on our way. And that solved that problem. And I never looked back, and I had no regrets. But the alcoholism really got me, and it got me by my short hair or whatever you want to call it. And it didn't take too long to find out there was something wrong in our lives. It just happened really fast. I didn't ease into it over a 20-year period like some people. It just happened really fast. I knew something was wrong. And I couldn't figure out why I couldn't fix it, why I couldn't change it. And it had to be something wrong with me, that I couldn't figure out a solution to the things that was going on in our home. I didn't want to call the cops because we were living in a small town and the cops knew him better than I did. And I didn't want anybody to know, you know, what was going on. And we both worked at the same place, so I put on this happy face at work and I didn't let anybody know that we were having problems. My husband was a happy drinker and he was a violent drinker. We never knew, and that's what alcoholism is when you can't predict, you know, when we would leave for the evening what was going to happen by the time we got home. Anyway, we bounced our way through this for a couple of years, and finally God really did start working in our lives, and it just happened so fast. My husband found himself in treatment, and I found myself in treatment, and I was told to go to Al-Anon. And so I did. I was I just was willing to try anything. I had it. And I couldn't walk away. I couldn't pack my bags and walk out this time, and I couldn't figure that out either. The whole thing just had me in a terrible state. The people in Al-Anon and AA both really, really saved my life and our lives. The Al-Anon program gave me a place to go where people would listen to me, and where I couldn't laugh my way through things. I had to honestly face things and face myself and find out that I was scared to death. I knew I was scared of snakes. I mean, that I admitted to. But that was the only thing. I could just handle anything. And I didn't need help from anybody. But in Al-Anon, we've just made so many friends, and these people would just... I really like to thank the couples that have seen us through this past 6 years. There's some people that spent some nights up all night with us and stuff. Because I found out, one of the first things I found out is when the bottle was gone, the problems weren't gone. And so some of the same things that happened in the drinking continued in sobriety for us. And that was painful for me because I thought I had solved the solution by getting rid of the bottle. I think it's changed my whole personality. I lost a lot of my assertiveness and things that I had to have had before I got into this alcoholism thing. And I'm gradually getting that back, my sense of humor back. We can laugh about the things that happened before, which is neat. One another thing that came to light in all this was the drinking in my own family. My parents didn't drink, and we didn't have it in the house, but my brothers really enjoyed their social drinking. They would go to Reno and bring back booze and put heavy-duty shocks on the car, you know, to bring it back. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with that at all until I'd been in the program for a while, and I realized that's probably not what everybody does when they go to Reno. We'd only just been in AA and recovery about 2 months, and my youngest brother, who was 10 years older than I am, committed suicide. And he was one of these quiet fellows that sat in the chair, and his wife was the one that shoved her fist through the plate glass windows and made the terrible scenes in the bar, you know. And we never could figure out what was wrong with her, because he was such a laid-back, mellow guy. But after this happened, which if it hadn't been for these programs, I don't know what we'd have done. That's the first thing we did, was hit meetings and call people, and because it was something that is really hard to deal with and get through, because especially, you know, we felt we should have been able to do something because we did have this new information, and we just... questioned God's will, why we had a chance for recovery and he didn't. You know, it's hard to understand those things. So the program can really be used to get you through these hard times. About a year later, my other brother, he admitted and he knew that he needed the booze really bad. He was taking antidepressant pills because he was so depressed. And then, drink his drinks. And I look back on that, and I can see where my sister-in-law did the driving probably for 5 or 6 years prior to this. But he had a massive heart attack, and he died. And we know that that's from alcoholism now. So this social thing that I thought was my family was really, you know, it was really there. And it was there all the time, and I didn't see it. I learned to think that we were social butterflies, and that was the thing to do to have a good time. And when they tell you it'll kill you, it'll kill you. It really will. You don't have any choice. They didn't have any choice, evidently. So the programs have really been good to us. And I'm really grateful for all the people and the chance to get up here and talk. I know I'm not well yet, but I'm not as sick as I was. So, and I have a long way to go. One of the things that I really need to work on is this higher power thing. I thought that God had really, you know, he's out to get me, because these things had happened in my life. My family is gone. I have one brother left out of all those people. And, so here I am. So I don't know what that means, but... You know, I finally got to work these things out by myself. I don't have anybody really to turn to except this higher power. And I like what I hear in AA and Al-Anon about higher power, because I don't think he's out to get me. And I don't think this higher power, this God, thinks I'm such a terrible sinner. I think he thinks I'm probably okay because he's given me a chance to learn more about his will for me and what my life can be like. Is that 15 minutes? I have a new dress I've saved for this. From the first time I heard somebody speak, I thought, I'm going to have to do that someday. And all these thoughts have been going through my mind, what I would wear. And this has been going on for 6 years. Just nothing wrong with me. Anyway, I hope everybody has a happy Christmas, and we're really looking forward to Christmas this year. Thank you.